What are the great movies, pieces of literature that that look at the subject of loneliness? One is Travis Bickle's character in the movie Taxi Driver. Do you remember him? He just drives around. One of the most alienated, lost, lonely people I think you ever see in film. At one point he says, "Loneliness has followed my entire life. Everywhere, in bars, cars, sidewalk stores, everywhere. There's no escape." He ends up, you know, having that terribly bloody kind of gun scene. Do you remember that? No one's watched Taxi Driver. Come on. Is it Robert De Niro? Yeah. The other one's Lost in Translation. And here's a little, do you know this one? Is this going to work, Taylor? Here we go. You know, Bill Murray, Scarlett Johansson, Lost in Translation. It's a comedy with all the elements of a tragedy. It's set in Tokyo, emphasizing the disorientation of their lives. There they are, with millions of people around them and terribly lonely. And the cinematography is just stunning, and it just reinforces, you know, there's this one shot of Scarlett Johansson smoking beside this window, looking out onto Tokyo. Just such a bleak scene. And Charlotte, played by Scarlett Johansson, she has this degree and a marriage which should mark out her adult life, but she still has no idea what she wants to do with life. Bob has a successful film career, but's reduced to making whiskey commercials for Japanese distilleries. And they meet each other, lost in career, lost in relationship, lost in this foreign culture, lost in translation. Their lives are just lost and lonely. And loneliness very much is a significant problem in our society today. Michael Flood of the Australian Institute, he says that one in five Australians right now between the age of 25 and 44 are in the midst of an intense period of loneliness. One in five on your row. Intense loneliness. And my experience is, as I speak to you guys, that that really is the truth. I think one of the things which takes us by surprise is that the research actually shows that men are more lonely than women. And I think usually we think it's the other way around, but it isn't. And I think one of the interesting things about loneliness is it's actually very hard to talk about. Many people say that, you know, it's easy to tell people that I'm depressed, I'm anxious, but actually to say to someone I feel lonely is actually a very shameful experience. No one wants to talk about it, and I think that's because what loneliness is what one person has described. It's proximity without intimacy. Proximity without intimacy. And that's why you can live in a city of 4 million people and feel terribly alone. That's why you can be married and have children and a wife or husband and feel terribly alone. Intimacy, what is intimacy? Intimacy is being known and loved. Being known and loved. And loneliness is proximity. Okay, this person knows me, but there's no depth of knowledge, and they actually don't love me. And that's, I think, why it is such a shameful thing to talk about. Because to admit that no one knows me or loves me, that essentially people have rejected me, that cuts right to the core of who we are as people. And as a result, psychologists and doctors actually go on to say that loneliness is much more damaging than depression, loss, grief, anxiety, or even smoking cigarettes. It causes stress, sleeplessness, cognitive decline, a weakened immune system, and a rapid path to an early death. This is a significant issue in our society. It's rooted in the need to be loved and known. And one of the interesting quotes I read as I was preparing for this is a little quote in an essay by Thomas Wolfe, the American novelist. And he says this: "The whole conviction of my life now rests upon the belief that my sense of loneliness, far from being a rare and curious phenomenon peculiar to myself and a few other solitary people, no, is the central and inevitable fact of human existence. He says, it's not rare, it's not kind of uncommon, it's not just me and some lonely people, it's universal. What's interesting, though, is he calls that essay in which he describes that, he calls that essay God's Lonely Man. And that's the thing, he didn't believe in God, and so as a result, he stood in a bleak and indifferent universe without someone knowing him or loving him. Without someone knowing him and loving him. And Psalm 139, that's why this is such a moving and wonderful psalm in the Bible. There are four stanzas. Each stanza has six verses long. And notice that from beginning to end, the writer of this psalm, who is King David, his thoughts are captured by the God who knows him intimately. And so let's work our way through it. And the first thing we see here is that our God, knows everything about us. The technical word for this is God's omniscience, meaning that he is omni-knowing everything about you. He knows everything about you. So look at verse 1 with me. O Lord, David prays, O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely. O Lord, you hem me in behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. David's struck by how much God knows of him. He realizes that he never, ever goes unnoticed. And this is true for all of us. And the technical word is God's omniscience. He knows everything about you. But his knowledge isn't just exhaustive like Google. It is personal. And that's why David formulates this idea not as some kind of doctrinal statement, but as a poem, this vivid piece of poetry, because he knows God's knowledge of him is personal and active. We read here that God searches our thoughts, verse 2. He's not disinterested in heaven, there's Toby, blah, you know. No, he's interested. He's searching your mind right now. He's listening to your inner thought process. But not only does he know us on the inside, he knows us on the outside as well. He discerns our going out and our lying down. His knowledge is wonderful, David says. His knowledge surrounds us and sustains us, verse 5. So he knows everything, not only on the inside, but on the outside. You see, when we look at things, we see things from the outside, but it's very hard to discern what's going on for someone on the inside. We can see people when they're near, but it's very hard to see them when they are far away. But here is God, and he knows us when we're near, when we're far. He knows us when we're doing stuff, and he knows us when we're thinking stuff. You're known. You're known. And it's incredible. And look down at verse 4 there. Before a word is on my tongue, before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely. That's incredible, isn't it? He sees not only your past, your present, but even your future. He knows what you're going to say before you say it. He knows what you're going to say, not just in 5 seconds, but in 5 minutes, 5 days, 5 months, 5 years, 50 years. He knows what you're going to say before you even say it. I think there's this wonderful moment in The Lord of the Rings, and I've been listening to the audio, the BBC production, which they played on audio decades ago, and I've been listening to it at the moment, and there's a moment in it when one of the very great kings lies down in the tomb of kings to die, and he says goodbye to everyone, and then he dies. And there's this great line which goes something like this. It says, and everyone who looked upon him at that moment did so in wonder. For the grace of his youth, the valor of his manhood, and the wisdom and majesty of his age were all blended together. Long there he lay, a vision of the splendor of the kings of men in glory undimmed before the breaking of the world. At that moment, it says that everyone got a glimpse, not just that he's present, he's an old man, but his entire life. They saw the grace of his youth, the valor of his manhood, and the wisdom and majesty of his age. All of those things put together. And that's how God sees you. God sees everything. Your past, your present, and your future. You only see a very small slice of your life. You see yourself, most of you, as young. But and you see yourself as whatever it is. Maybe some of you see yourself as old. But God sees you, your complete life. He knows your completeness of life. And as a result, you're surrounded by his knowledge of you. He knows you better than you will know yourself now or in the future or ever. And he sees everything about you. It's incredible, isn't it? That's why David goes on. Such knowledge is wonderful, wonderful, verse 6. One of the things I stumbled over a couple of years ago is a French format artist by the name of Thierry Jeffery. Anyone heard of him? No. Anyway, he does some weird stuff, and one of his artworks was little poems he wrote on ripped up cardboard, and they don't look like much, but actually one I was really taken by, and here's one of his pieces, and what it says there is, he says, where's my sheet? I can't see it. To see if I still exist, I Google my name. I love that. You ever Googled your name? When was the last time you Googled your name? I can't remember when it was, but I've done it. I've totally done it more than once, I'm sure. That's a terrible thing. You know, I love how he's referencing Descartes. You know, I Google my name and I exist on the internet, therefore I am. That's how I know I exist. No, you're known by God who knows you more personally. He knows you as exhaustively as Google, but he knows you personally and actively. It's remarkable, isn't it? Okay, that's the first thing, his omniscience. Secondly, we turn to his omnipresence. That is, he is always present with you wherever you go. He's with us always. And you see that in verse 7 to 12, the second stanza. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed on the depths, you're there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light will become night around me, no, even the darkness will be not dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. So David considers whether he could escape God by climbing up Mount Everest or going down into the Marinara Sea Trench. And he can't escape God. Even if he hides in the dark, his conclusion is not only can you can't outrun God, nor can you escape him. There are no limits to God's knowledge of me, and so also there is no bounds to his presence with me. And you see, there is therefore no God-forsaken place on earth. Jonah runs and tries to hide. He finds a ship and hides inside, but God sent winds to blow outside. I'm quoting, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm quoting one of Archie's little kid's Bible. He runs, he hides, and yet God sends winds and he captures him. You can't escape God anywhere. Many of you may feel abandoned by God. You may feel no one cares about you, that you're lonely, but God's promise here is verse 10, even there where you are right now, your hand, David says, will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. David's not just giving us facts about God, is he? He's telling us about how his heart responds to those facts. Short little plug for musicians and songwriters and poets. We need you to be writing about your experience, about how you respond to the facts about God. But I find something interesting in this passage is David is, he's not actually sure whether it's a good thing that God kind of hunts him down and pursues him wherever he goes. I think that's all of our experience as well. If God is everywhere, if he sees everything, if he's involved in every fiber of my being, therefore I can't escape him. And for some of us, that feels suffocating. And that's because our society tells us, no, if you are to be free, then you should live the way you want to live. Live as you decide to live. You don't have freedom if someone else is right there beside you telling you what to do. And therefore, for many people, an all-present God, an omnipresent God, that's a terrifying thing. It's a nightmare. And many people have picked up on this. And many people say, if there is no God, then there's freedom. We have freedom to do what we want. And that's a great reason to stop believing in God. It means we're free. If there is a God, that means he controls everything and he controls me. But if there isn't a God, then I'm free. But here's the problem with that, of course, is that if there is no God, then there is no God to guide you in the midst of the darkness of life. And I think that's why this poem is so wonderful. Even though we try and escape God, we try and climb up to the heavens to escape him or down into the depths to escape God, we can't. We can't outrun him. And the wonderful thing there is that everywhere you go, that means his hand is there to guide you. His right hand holds us fast. He guides us so we don't get lost. Even when we feel lost, he's there and he will guide you. See, if you want to be free, that means there's no hand to guide you. But if you want a hand to guide you, here's the wonderful truth of this psalm, is that there is a God with you. You can't escape him. It's great comfort. It's very, very comforting. Even in the darkness, what does it say? Surely the darkness will hide me. Surely there are some times of desperation and despair and suffering where God's absent, surely. And the psalmist says, no, even the darkness will not be dark to you. In suffering, danger, death, terrible disease, when you're feeling, I'm totally lost, do you have a God who is present there? Yes, David knows it. Just remember who David is at this moment. He was the one that God chose to replace King Saul as king of Israel. Saul finds out about that and he realizes David is the threat to his position as king and he hunts him down. And David just runs all over the countryside. He lives in caves. This sounds exciting, doesn't it? But I don't know if you've ever been camping without a tent. You've forgotten your tent. You're 10 kilometers in. It starts raining. No tent. What do? You've got to hide in a dirty, muddy, cold cave. That was his life for years. On the hunt with guys with spears and swords and an army of 300-500 people wanting you dead. And yet God had chosen David and said to David, you're going to be the king. I've chosen you among all the people. I've chosen you. If anybody who's ever lived would have felt God's abandoned him for the task God had chosen him for, that's him. You just get into the head of this guy. And yet he goes, no, even in the darkness of the cave, maybe that's where he's writing us, even in the darkness, you are there with me. Holding my hand, it's incredible, isn't it? So not only is he omniscient, he's omnipresent, and then we have him omnipotent. Verse 13 to 18, do you see it there? The third stanza, omnipotent, what does that mean? All-powerful. And have a look, verse 13. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame wasn't hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious, precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, that outnumber the grains of the sand. When I awake, I'm still with you. Now surely if there was ever a time when I wasn't known by God, it was when I was a microscopic ball of cells traveling down the fallopian tubes of my mother's wombs, right? That's when surely, my mum doesn't even know I exist there then. And yet here we are told, even when my mother didn't know I existed, God knew me and was knitting me together. You and I are created by God and upheld by Him. We're told here that all the days of our life are ordained by God, verse 16. They're written in His book before they even come to be. Not only does He create us, sustain us, uphold us, know us, He ordains your history. You know, one end of life is conception. He says, in my mother's womb, you were knitting me together there. What about at the other end of life? At the very end of your life, when you're feeling old and forgotten and that you have no purpose in life, He says, no, it's ordained. Every single day on earth that you live is ordained. There's a plan, there's a purpose, there's a reason. He knows you. He has a plan for your life. And He is there with you in the midst of it. Incredible, isn't it? He knits us together. He knows us. And He ordains our life. From conception to last breath, He's in charge. He sustains, upholds, ordains. Now, what's the ethical implications of this? Well, it's difficult to talk about this, isn't it? One reason is because some of you have had this experience. But one of the ethical implications of this, it's the reason everybody over the centuries who's taken this doctrine seriously, whether it's Christians or Jewish people, this is a Jewish psalm, it's why everyone who's taken this seriously have always said that both abortion and active euthanasia is wrong. Now, why is that? It's because you're putting yourself into the place of God. God is in charge of all the parts of our life. Life in the very, very beginning and life at the very, very end. It's fragile and sometimes inconvenient. But God knows us right at the very beginning, and He knows us right at the very end. And that's actually what makes us human, His knowledge of us. And what God therefore regards as precious, He asks us to likewise regard as precious. Now that opens all kinds of questions, and we need to be sensitive to that. And I'd love to come and talk to you about that. But here I think one of the implications is that which God knows and regards as precious, we ought to know and regard as precious. When you and I were in the womb, you're you. He knew you even then, and He will know you when you're old and senile and forget everyone else. You're known by Him, powerfully and wonderfully made. And then fourthly, and finally, not only is He omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, but He is also holy, terrifyingly holy. And this last stanza in the song, it's an aspect of God's character which was near to David's heart, but which is very often not very close to our heart. Look down at verse 19 to 24. If only, God, you would slay the wicked. Away from me, you bloodthirsty man. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Don't I hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Now that comes as a little bit of a shock don't you think? David suddenly switches from meditations on the greatness of God to murderous prayers in the name of God. It's jarring, don't you think? It jars me, and as a result, most preachers preach all the way up to verse 18 and leave the rest of it. I've got a feeling, Andy, Brian, the knower of all things Anglican, I've got a feeling that in the prayer book, I think this section is at this end of the psalm. I don't think they include it in the daily readings of the psalms, do they? Psalm 95. Well, I don't know which one it is, but all I'm saying is people struggle with this psalm significantly, and maybe I should just sit down at this point, okay? But I shouldn't. One of the reasons that we find this so difficult is we are confronted here with the holiness of God. God does hate evil, and He hates evildoers. And yet within God's heart, He has the capacity to both love and hate evildoers. And here, another reason we struggle with this is because the New Testament explicitly forbids us to praying like this. The New Testament says that we're not to pray curses on our enemies. Rather, we're to pray, Father, forgive them. It's the example of Jesus on the cross that we're to follow. We're supposed to do good to those who abuse us. We're not allowed to retaliate toward those who mistreat us. We're supposed to pray for our enemies. Now, what therefore happened? What happened between David and you and I, which changes everything? The Bible actually says you and I must never speak the way David is speaking. What changed? What happened so that there was actually a change as we read this? Well, what happened is that King David's greater son, who died on the cross, paying so that the enemies, your enemies, might be forgiven by God. That's what's happened. And that's why we struggle to read this, because we don't sit in the position of ancient Israel. That's why you've got to be very careful to make some parts of the Bible your key verse for your life, because they weren't originally written for your situation. And so you shouldn't make some verses which are written for other situations your key verses. So you come and talk to me about that later. Poor old Anna Schraft has learnt this one the hard way. And we've been wrestling with that. But here's an example why. We're not to pray this. Why? Because we stand on this side of the cross. David's on that side. Now, what David knew, because God had him by the hand, darkness would turn to light. David knew that everywhere he goes, God is with him, seeing everything he does. And that actually makes him flinch and kind of hide. Why does he want to hide? Because he knows his life. He knows there's things in his life that would prefer not to be seen. And so he has this terrible tension in this poem. Read it over and over and you'll see it. At one point, he's very excited that God knows everything about him and is with him everywhere he goes. And at another level, he's terrified by it, because it means that God knows and sees all the wickedness that he ends up in. But let me try and resolve this for you. David knew, because God had hid him, even the darkness would turn to light. But here along comes Jesus, David's greater son. And he is the one for whom God actually did let his hand go. And even as the midday light should have shone most brightly on that day as Jesus was dying on the cross, what happened? Darkness descended. David was knit together in his mother's womb, and Jesus, though beloved of the Father, was torn apart on the cross. Why? Why did Jesus get the absence of God? Why did Jesus get torn away from God? Why does he lose his Father's hand? Because he was getting what you and I deserve for running and getting away from God. We try and live our own lives escaping the inescapable. God is with you wherever you go. And we try and escape that reality by living life the way we want to. And he sees it, he knows it, He doesn't just see the attitudes come out and the behavior come out. He knows what's on your heart as you're doing it. And you ought to pay for that. But Jesus pays. He experiences the darkness. He's torn apart so that you'd get the hand of God, the light of God's acceptance and favor, the welcome that he deserved, but he was rejected. That's why we stand on this side. Jesus has done something to turn enemies into God's children, and therefore how dare we curse our enemies? We must treat our enemies the way Jesus is treating them. Right now, as Simeon said last week, God has offered our world an amnesty. He says, put down your weapons. I'm going to forgive you. And in fact, if you come back, not only will you not be my enemies anymore, you won't even just be servants. You'll become my children. Now's the day of amnesty. How dare you and I to curse our enemies? That's why Jesus says, no. You're to pray for them. You're not to retaliate. We stand on this side of the cross. But still there's an edge to this, isn't there? Because it does mean he's still always with us, and he does see what you're doing, and therefore there are some things that you need to stop doing if you're going to follow Jesus. Are you following Jesus? He's taking you this way. Some of you, you're going that way. You're acting as though you're still on the throne. And he's saying, actually, stop that. Turn around. Start following me. For those of you who aren't, you're just checking this stuff out, welcome. You know what? First of all, you've got to trust the one you're being asked to follow before you actually have to leave the stuff, the direction you're heading in at the present. Trust him. Work it out. Come along to Christianity Explored and check that up. If you're a Christian, you can't keep going that way if he's taking you this way. Drop it. He sees it. He knows you. There is an edge to this, isn't there? A key part of feeling lonely is feeling rejected. And I think that's the most damaging part of loneliness. Loneliness is proximity without intimacy. It's to be seen, but not known and loved. And how is God towards you if you've put your trust in him? He knows everything about you. I mean, that's without a question. But his giving of his son for you shows that actually he sees all the way into you, all the dark bits, and yet he loves you. He loves you all the same. Most of us don't think that could possibly happen. And that's why I think most relationships have this moment when we start a friendship or something like that and everything's good. And then you ever get into a relationship where the other person starts criticizing you for stuff they see in your life and you can't cope with that? Why is that? Because they've learned too much about us. And we think because they've seen everything at that point, they would never love us. Now, we know that's not true about the way we love others, but it is true about the way we actually receive the love of others. And that's why we hide. We don't want them to see because we don't want them to reject us. Along comes God and he says, no, I see everything. I see right to the bottom. And I love you. That's, I think, the cure. That's the end of loneliness. You can be orphaned. You can be alone on an island, stranded. And you can go through, you know, times of immense despair, not having people around you. But that deep-seated loneliness of not being known and loved, that's not actually something that should be that acute if you know God and trust him. Now, lest you just think, Toby, that's just words. Let me prove that to you with an example. Here's Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the most remarkable men of last century. I'm going to finish on this. And a week before his death in a Nazi camp, he was a German minister who protested the Nazi regime. They locked him up. He was involved in the Valkyrie plot to assassinate Hitler, and he spoke against the Nazi regime. They locked him up. And 1 week before the end of World War II, he was executed. And 1 week before that, he wrote this poem. And he was a very respected Christian pastor around the world. People in America said to him when he was over there visiting, they said, don't go back to Germany, they'll lock you up. And he said, no, I've got to go back to my people. So very well known. This is what he says. It's profound. I'm just going to work through it with you. Who am I? He says, they often tell me I step from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerfully, firmly, like a squire from his country house. What's he saying there? He's saying, what do other people, who am I? Well, what do other people say about me? They tell me, you know what? I'm confident. I'm courageous. I've got this. I'm in prison, but you know what? Doesn't faze me. I've got this. Who am I? They often tell me I used to speak to my warders freely and friendly and clearly as though it were mine to command. Even though locked up, I trust God in this situation. Who am I? They also tell me I bore the days of misfortune equally smilingly, proudly, like one accustomed to win. He's reflecting, who am I? What do other people say about me? They see, you know, this awesome Christian hero of the 20th century. But then look where he goes. Am I then really all that which other men tell of? Or am I only what I myself know of myself, restless and longing and sick like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath as though hands were compressing my throat, yearning for colors, for flowers, for the voices of birds, thirsting for words of kindness, for neighborliness, tossing in expectation of great events, powerlessly trembling for friends at an infinite distance they are, weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making, faint, and ready to say farewell to it all. He contrasts. This is how people see me. This is actually what's going on in my life. I love that. Like a bird in a cage. Where does he go next? He says, who am I, this or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once, a hypocrite before others? They see this confident pastor locked up in jail, trusting God, but I don't know what's going on inside. Or am I both at once, a hypocrite before others and before myself, a contemptibly woebegone weakling? Or is something within me still like a beaten army fleeing in disorder from victory already achieved? He's lost, terribly lonely, at the point of despair, trying to understand who is he? How does he know himself? Who am I? And I love his last paragraph. Here he goes. Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine, but whoever I am, thou knowest. Oh God, I'm thine. Such a powerful ending, isn't it? He is so racked with all this insecurity on the inside. He sees how people look at him, such a courageous Christian pastor, and he knows really what's happening on the inside. Struggles to work out who he is. And in the end, he says, screw it all. I don't care who I think of myself. Who does God, what does he think of me? And he says, I'm his. He knows me. He sees everything about me. And that gives him great courage to press on. And I pray that that would give you great courage to press on in his service. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this psalm and the way the artists and poets and writers have evoked their experience of the great truths of knowing you. Father, we pray that you'd open up our minds and hearts to contemplate how rich this topic is, that you do know us and that you do love us, that we have tremendous intimacy with you. May that be the source of strength and courage for people in this room to step out into life, lowering their guard, removing the barriers which they erect, lest people see right to the heart of them and know all their flaws as well. May this give us great confidence to be able to lower that and to be known by others. Father, we just praise you that all of our lives, you see it and you've planned it. You see even the past mistakes we've made. You see right into our hearts and the way our hearts are tempted to live for lesser things other than your glory. And yet you sent your Son for us, and you offer your Spirit to us each and every day for cleansing and for power. We pray that we take up and walk by the Spirit, be filled with Him, so that we please you. We pray these things in Jesus' name.